Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Howard Phillips Smith about his new book, George Valentine Durow, Life and Art in New Orleans. Philip Smith is a writer and photographer known primarily for his historical works, which focus on expanding the scope of gay history, especially in New Orleans. He's the author of Unveiling the Muse, The Lost History of Gay Carnival in New Orleans, and A Sojourn in Paradise, Jack Robinson in 1950s New Orleans. Howard's photography was included in Louisiana Lens, photographs from the Historic New Orleans collection by John Lawrence. And today we're talking about his new book, his gorgeous new book, George Valentine Durow, Life and Art in New Orleans. Well, Howard Phillips Smith, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you very much.
And congratulations on this very gorgeous, heavy book.
yes.
Now, let us begin at the beginning. You grew up in Mississippi, except for some time here when you were a toddler. And then you spent a decade in the 80s here. Yes. And now you live in Los Angeles. But you have never lost your passion for the city.
You know, I continue to return to New Orleans, especially when my parents were alive. They live north of the lake. And I have so many friends there still. And, you know, there's a community of New Orleans lovers here in Los Angeles. We call ourselves expats. And we celebrate Fat Tuesday.
Well, you better. I mean,
yeah.
But all your books seem to me to be passion projects about New Orleans. So how did your story intertwine with George Durow's? Because this book is such a labor of love. It's lavishly illustrated. It's designed and written with such care. This is the work of years.
Yes. Well, you know, when I lived in New Orleans in the 80s, George Durow was really respected and revered, and I knew him. You know, I would talk to him at gallery openings, and when I would see him out and about in the French Quarter, I wasn't, a close friend, but definitely, you know, we crossed paths many times when I lived there. You know, I really never thought of doing a book about him. When I was working on the Jack Robinson book, I heard that his archive was at the Historic New Orleans Collection. So while I was there, I mean, this is almost 10 years ago, I thought I would take a peek. I was very curious. And of course, when I started looking and delving into that archive, I couldn't believe my eyes. I thought, you know, I would pass out from the vapors. So much. Call off the cotillion. So many things I had never seen before. And I thought, this is another facet of his life that we have never seen. So I knew right there was a book. In fact, at that time, I put together in my mind the plates for the book. And that really hasn't changed that much, because they were so novel, so new. And then I wanted to build a book around that, and my publisher was very open to that.
So describe some of your discoveries in the archive. I mean, you and I are archive people. You know, it's just, there's something about peeking in somebody's papers and pictures that's so much fun. So describe some of your discoveries and some of the things that you wanted to put out there for people to see.
Well, first of all, there were a lot of photographs with the circus.
Yes.
My God. this makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. It's its own universe. You have dwarves and malformed people like the bearded lady or the rubber boy, or it's its own little universe.
Right.
And the images of the circus that he took were so sparkling and interesting, and immediately I made a connection to his photographs from the circus series. Mm-hmm. Other things were photographs in color, still lifes, and portraits of many people in color, and they were riveting. Also, just portraits of people that I never knew that he photographed, like Quentin Crisp.
Oh, yeah.
And other people that I had, other scenes with people I had never seen before. So there was quite a lot. And as I kept delving into the archive, I discovered more and more things, and I wanted to pull them out and publish them.
Now, one of the most fascinating things about this book to me is that it's such a portrait, not just of the difference one artist can make, but how an artistic community grows and what it takes to build that kind of infrastructure over time. Because Durow's dates are 1930 to 2014,
right,
and they were formative dates in our artistic community here. And it covers a lot of major events: the beginnings of many influential galleries, the founding of the Contemporary Arts Center, several important exhibitions, the AIDS epidemic. It was a broad canvas for you to work with.
The World's Fair.
Yeah. And also the role of the French Quarter,
mm-hmm,
Mardi Gras, the founding of the Society of St. Anne. So talk about how you made the big choices of putting this book together.
Well, I sort of worked backwards, I guess, because I wanted to understand Durow's influences. I wanted to understand his career. I wanted to understand the people in his life. I think essentially I wanted to understand how Durow imbued his work with New Orleans. New Orleans was so important for his artwork, and New York just couldn't understand that. I mean, with paintings titled Fat Tuesday, Waiting for Comus, mm-hmm, I don't think New York could understand that. So Durow's work was quintessentially New Orleans, but how did that happen? How did he absorb all of this creativity and essence of New Orleans while he was growing up and living in the French Quarter and producing art? So, of course, like you said, the Contemporary Arts Center and the Orleans Gallery. He exhibited at the Orleans Gallery on Earl Street. He exhibited at the Contemporary Arts Center. The AIDS epidemic definitely was an influence on artworks in New Orleans. But I think Durow was at the height of his creative output during the 1980s. And I remember when I lived in New Orleans and I was exhibiting some of my photographs at that time at the Contemporary Arts Center and Lemieux Galleries.
Mm-hmm.
It was just this tidal wave of art, creativity. There were so many interesting artists, and we all interacted with each other, and we saw each other at the gallery openings, and it was a snowball effect. Everybody was excited to see new art, to see what was, mm-hmm, in the gallery.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Howard Philip Smith about his new book, George Valentine Durow, Life and Art in New Orleans. Several important editorial choices shaped this book. One of them that struck me particularly powerfully was the inclusion of these contact sheets. You saw so much of,
yeah,
a work being created, and I thought to show that process was really beautifully done. And then there are these generous, lengthy interviews with artists and other people who knew George. And I want you to tell us about some of them.
Yeah, while I was writing the book, we had COVID. We were at home for a couple of years.
Yeah.
This was, you know, it was a horrible time, this pandemic, but thank God, because I had all the time in the world to talk to people. And I was on the phone every day. You know, I would interview someone like Jacqueline Bishop, and she would tell me about Christopher Fisher. And,
mm-hmm,
you know, it was this network of people that I got in touch with, and I could really dig down into what Giroux meant to these people. And they were there. They knew him. They could tell me all about him. So the interviews, I wanted to include them. It's interesting because in my Southern Decadence book, I thought, oh, I don't really have a lot of, you know, there wasn't a lot of information. I couldn't write a 600-page book with that. So, I thought I would publish some of the interviews in the Southern Decadence book. And, you know, people to this day come up to me and say, the interviews were the best thing of that book. So it really is important. And the interviews in the Giroux book, you can see, if you look at them closely, you can see how I took information from those interviews and formulated my thesis for the book.
Mm-hmm. And with Kenneth, the thing, that was such a grace note that you included his eulogy, for example, and that wonderful quote, that perfect quote, George Valentine Giroux, named for two saints, one who fought dragons, one who became the very symbol of love, is a New Orleanian by birth and has remained one by choice. It just gives me goosebumps.
Like you said, it's a perfect encapsulation of Giroux. Yes. Mm-hmm. They were very close.
And another person who, and I really appreciated this because I think very often they don't get their share of credit, but I especially love that George DeVille was such a big part of your story.
He's so important. His bookstore and gallery, I mean, what a character. I mean, I knew him, you know. He was incredible. Both good and bad. At times he was hard to deal with, but he was a smart cookie. And he always wanted to open up an art gallery, and he did. And many, many of the great artists today, first, they got their first show at his DeVille Gallery. Jackie Bishop, Andrew Baskell, Giroux showed
right.
there.
And we forget that bookstores play such an important role as community centers, that they are more than just, you know, books on a shelf.
Absolutely. Especially DeVille and the people who would come to his bookstore. I mean, he had an incredible selection of art books and literature, fiction. It was just incredible.
And was relentless in shaping that New Orleans identity in literature and supporting those local writers and local artists.
Absolutely. And his bookstore became a nexus for artists. I was talking to Doug Bourgeois, and he said, every time I came to New Orleans, I made a beeline to the DeVille bookstore because I wanted to see what was new and what I could learn. I mean, and I think that was true for many, many people. I know it was true for me.
Mm-hmm.
I really depended on that.
I moved here in the late 80s, and DeVille Books was one of the first places I ever visited.
Really? I mean, yeah. So. I can believe it, yeah.
You know, just great. And then you do a lot with the beginning of the Contemporary Arts Center and artist activists who made that happen. So talk about some of those folks.
The Contemporary Arts Center, I feel, became the anchor when it opened in 76 for the burgeoning art scene and where it was located in the Warehouse District. It established this anchor, and all of a sudden you have Julia Street, where many, many galleries moved. So you had a center there, which was a focus of contemporary art. Before that, you only had the Orleans Gallery on Royal Street. And I think in the early 70s, artists were very frustrated because they didn't have a showcase, a showplace for their artworks. That was a serious center for their art. And so artists like Robert Tannen, mm-hmm. and, you know, his wife Jean Nathan, and, well, Bill Fegley, he was a curator at New Orleans Museum of Art, he was involved. And they had an epiphany at an opening in Bywater, that because so many people came out to this opening, and they realized that the community needed this center, and they started putting it together, and it fell into place pretty quickly. Sidney Bestoff donated a warehouse, you know, where it's still housed,
mm-hmm.
and artists helped renovate and clean it up. Elizabeth Shannon, for example, she said, I clean toilets with Don Marshall. Yeah, so yeah, he was the first director.
Right, right.
So, you know, it was really a group effort.
And you're showing what it takes to have a literary community there. You know, like you have to have the museum, you have to have the Contemporary Arts Center, you have to have dealers, you have to have critics as well, whom you write about.
You have to have the critics, and you have to have gallerists who are willing to take a leap of faith with artists. And, well, George Fevres opened his gallery, Jules Laforgue, at the end of Decatur Street. And that became a really important nexus for this new wave of young artists. And, of course, right there was the Arthur Roger Gallery, who really took a chance on new artists. It was he had really an incredible eye. I can't emphasize that enough. He really helped get this contemporary art scene going.
Now, you've spent years thinking about George and his life now.
Yes.
And I'm curious if you think time has finally caught up with him at last, or just how we're thinking. Are we ready to properly appreciate him now?
I think that's happening, Susan. Maybe not here. I think New Orleans has always known how important he was. Europe is now looking at him. Recently, there was a traveling show in Europe. I think it went to two or three venues, like in Germany and London, but not here. And the title of it was Masculinities. And Durow was included in this book. And it really showed the importance of how he portrayed different aspects of masculinity. The photographs in that exhibit were of B.J. Robinson, who was only a torso. He had no legs. And the essay about him talks about, you know, he does have this incredible beauty, even though it's not this kind of typical male beauty that you think of, like a bodybuilder or something, or a model. It was this just kind of inherent masculinity. And George Durow was written about as a really important artist. So I'm hoping that's going to start. Well, in this book too, I hope.
I hope so too.
You know, we'll spread the word nationally and internationally, and just show from the artworks. You know, don't take my word for it. Look at the artworks. How really important he is. He's such an important artist, and he really needs to have a major show, Metropolitan Museum or San Francisco Museum.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Howard Philip Smith about his new book, George Valentine Durow, Life and Art in New Orleans. Talk about what his art has meant to you particularly, too. You share that love of photography. You've obviously given this a lot of thought. What inspires you about him?
I think his most important contribution is nude portraits of men. You know, the history of the male nude in art is very conflicted, because in classical Greece, ancient Rome, we see statues of the male nude, no problem. And it seems like even up to the 19th century, you couldn't have a male nude unless it was like a historical painting. You see a lot of generals, sometimes in a painting they're nude, or some kind of classical mythological context, like Apollo and Daphne. They're nude. You can get away with it like that.
Yeah.
But to have a photograph with the frontal nude of a man was just pornography until recently. You know, and the police were just, you know, they wanted to ferret out all of this stuff. For example, Luba Glade, who had a wonderful gallery in the French Quarter, was forced to close because the police or the city deemed some of her artwork unfit for the public. And George Durow, when he started photographing nude black men, he added another wedge into this story, another pie piece, because this was during the tail end of Jim Crow. And to show a black man in artistic terms was almost heresy. And that's what really inspired me, because he changed, you know, he was very confident and he was bold, but he never shirked his vision with these portraits. He wanted to show a black man, a nude man, in all of their strength, their vulnerability, their personality almost. So I was very taken with that. The more I look at those, the more I study those, there's just a beauty in those photographs that it's awe-inspiring still to this day. And people just, you know, right off the bat with his career, when he started photographing nude men, nude black men, the public in New Orleans bought his work. Mm-hmm. They didn't hesitate. He was successful. And it was the right time at the right place. I think 10 years earlier, he wouldn't have gotten away with it. Do you see what I mean? It would have been a scandal. But at the time, 1979, at George DeVille's gallery, that was his first, I think it was called Photographs of Men, first exhibition, and it was a huge success.
Well, he was very bold. I mean, he was a New Orleanian in every way that mattered. I mean, you would drive down the street and he would be lounging about on the stoop. You know what I mean? And Jared Johnson down the street a ways too. And he was a great New Orleans character that people were proud of.
Absolutely. But the image you just conjured, if you will, you know, he was out and about looking at people, talking to people. And that's why his artwork is so successful. He wanted to learn about New Orleans and delve under the surface.
And you look at that beautiful, all those beautiful photographs of his studio.
His studio was very important, yes.
That's one of those places people can identify without ever having set foot in it. I mean,
he wanted, like the circus, I said, was its own little universe.
Yeah.
Well, DeRosa's studio was his little universe. And he needed space to put up different artworks that he was working on so he could just keep up the momentum. He would have four or five paintings he would be working on at one time, and then someone would show up for a photo session and he would stop and photograph them. And then he would use some of those photographs to make drawings or to include some of the people he photographed in his paintings. So it was this symbiotic relationship with painting, drawing, and photography. He used them interchangeably.
And life and art.
Yes, absolutely. His life reflected the art reflected his life, I should say.
Right. And it's that, you know, kind of interesting life you can forge for yourself only in New Orleans, I think, sometimes.
He would not have it any other way. And he just really made that happen for himself. I mean, he was able to set up his studio exactly the way he wanted to and make the artwork that he wanted to. He was very confident, again, with his vision. So the studio, and there were several of them, but they were very important in his progression, I think.
What is it like for you to work so long and so hard on a project like this, here and away, and then kind of bring it back to the city? It's kind of an offering on your part. Is that nerve-wracking for you? Is it fun for you?
No, it's so interesting to me to be able to uncover this these things about the city. When I start out on a project like this, and I was having a conversation with a documentary maker about this, my focus on what I want to do is not there yet when I at the very beginning of a research project. But as I learn people and events and things like that, things start coming into focus. A good example is an exhibition catalog from DeRoe's CAC show in 1977. It was a mid-career retrospective. Don Marshall gave me this catalog, and I was looking at it, and I'm reading it, and, you know, it's very interesting. But when I came back to it, let's say 8 years later, I knew everything, every aspect of what I was looking at in that catalog. Oh. I knew all the models and the paintings and the drawings. I knew everything about it. And that's what happens when you really do your research. The picture of George DeRoe became more in focus as the years went by. So I think that's the secret to good research, is to let that picture develop.
Right. It's the wonderful image, especially for him. We've been talking with Howard Phillips Smith, whose new book is George Valentine DeRoe, art, and life in New Orleans. You can meet him Wednesday, May 28th at 6 at the Historic New Orleans Collection, Thursday, May 29th at 6 at Frenchman Books, Friday, May 30th at 6 at Octavia Books, and again Saturday, May 31st at 3 at Arthur Roger Gallery. Howard, thank you so much, and congratulations on this great work.
Well, thank you, and it has been a pleasure, as always.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. MC Therese discusses and signs her first novel, This Could Be Paradise, Sunday, May 25th from 1 to 2:30 at Blue Cypress Books. Sheila Sundar discusses and signs her novel Habitations and appears in conversation with Deisha Filyaw, Tuesday, May 27th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. Frank Perez signs Rainbow Fleur-de-Lis, Essays on Queer New Orleans History, Thursday, May 29th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Howard Philip Smith discusses and signs George Valentine Dureau, Life and Art in New Orleans, Wednesday, May 28th at 6 at the Historic New Orleans Collection, Thursday, May 29th at 6 at Frenchman Books, Friday, May 30th at 6 at Octavia Books, and Saturday, May 31st at 3 at Arthur Roger Gallery. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.